Meditation.
Alright, so, good times, bad times, impermanent. Alright, all things produced are impermanent. And we can debate this, by the way, if anyone wants to debate. All things impermanent, all things produced are impermanent. What's something that's permanent and not impermanent? The law of impermanence, no. Karma's impermanent? No, karma's impermanent. Cause and effect. Where cause happens, effect results, finished. What's something that's permanent?
Death.
What?
Death.
Space? Did someone say space?
Is it
didn't say space? Well, it's space. Space is permanent. Why is space permanent? No. Space is permanent. Space is permanent. No. It's empty, but it's not permanent.
It's a perspective.
No.
You don't
space isn't produced. It's filled up, but it's not produced. Okay? Is that reasonable?
Relative, but it's not.
Yeah.
It might be permanent.
Yeah. It's relative in the fact that it has direction, it can be filled up, but it's permanent in that space is not produced. Is everyone okay with that? We don't produce, there's nothing that produces space. It is, the function of space is to be filled up. All right, yeah, go on.
So space is filled up, but it's no longer.
Well, that depends. See, we might think that this fills up space. But if you get down to micron size, how much space is there between the molecules? Or if you get down to quark size, any physicists, have we got any physicists here? Good. That's right, I remember you're a physicist. Okay, so what happens if we get down to subatomic particles? Is there a lot of space?
Yeah, pretty much everything.
Everything's space. There we go. The physicist has spoken. But that's good. I mean, I find it very encouraging that science and Buddhism sits very comfortably together. Right? It's a very comfortable marrying of science and Buddhism is very, very closely related. So the smaller we get, the more space we have. So space just gets filled up, but mostly it's just all space. Okay, let's talk about the mind. Now, is the mind permanent? This is a tricky one. Is the mind permanent? From a Buddhist perspective, it's had no beginning, and it has no end. Wouldn't that suggest that the mind was permanent? It would suggest it. Think about it. You can wait here all night for an answer. No, well, the truth about the mind is impermanent but enduring. This is what Buddhism talks about, the enduring mind. So there is no beginning, there is no end. But the mind keeps producing itself. One moment of mind gives rise to the next moment of mind. So therefore the previous moment of mind is decayed. Therefore it's impermanent. So you can see that the mind... And the same with enlightenment. One moment of Buddha's enlightenment, it's enduring, so therefore it continues. But one moment of enlightened mind gives rise to the next moment of enlightened mind. So there is a continuum.
When you're dead.
Hmm? When you no longer exist in bodily form,
where is your mind?
The mind continues.
Where?
Depends what you've created.
For you, then.
Well, exactly, absolutely, for me.
For you, where will your mind be?
I don't know. I'm crossing my fingers it won't be a bad migration. But I can't tell you the truth there. But the truth of it is, from a Buddhist perspective, the mind continues, and so it continues on continuous cycles of rebirth. Alright? Continuous cycles of rebirth. Round and round and round we go. Until somehow we decide to pull the plug and step off the cycle. That's called nirvana, where we cease the karmic influences that push us into the next life. And that's really why Buddhists go, really want to get off the cycle, because the first truth of the Buddha was that life is suffering. And we have suffering. Look, we can say, okay, and now we're getting into the idea of impermanence, we can say, oh, well, we've just bought a bunch of flowers, you know, they die and we throw them out. If we've paid a lot of money and they die within a day, that's a little bit of suffering, okay? You know, if they last a week, we're okay with that. However, when we talk about people and people we love, that's intense suffering when they become impermanent. The truth of it is, they are impermanent. And one of the things that the Buddha said was that we don't accept impermanence. And it's one of the most important realizations of us freeing ourselves from getting caught up in misery. I've said here before, if you look at a sunset, you can see a sunset in the evening and you look at it and you go, that's just fantastic. We all know it's impermanent. We don't hold on to the sunset unless you're racing for your camera. And you miss it. And then you're annoyed because the best sunset you've ever seen and you didn't take a snapshot of it to show everyone the best sunset you've ever seen. So the idea of understanding impermanence allows us freedom in some sense. And I was saying to some of you earlier, I don't normally read things, but I've got some great quotes here, and one of them's from Thich Nhat Hanh, great Buddhist master. And we'll just sort of digest this. I'm not just going to rattle it at you, but I just want you to kind of have a digest this a little bit, contemplate about these words. Nothing remains the same for two consecutive moments. Think about doing the washing up. You go to do the washing up and you go, oh, I can't stand the washing up, it's a real drudge. But you have never done it the same before, or will you do it the same afterwards? There is no two moments in time exactly the same. Everything that you do has changed. There are no two the same consecutive moments. Everything has been reborn in a sense like that continuously. Everything is in a state of fluidity. How long does it take for our body cells to change through our body? Is it something like a 7-year cycle, is it, or something? Where's the medical students here? Well, okay. Let me tell you that the cells get replaced, don't they? The cells of our body get replaced. So our bodies change constantly. A Greek philosopher said, we can never bathe twice in the same river. Looks the same river, seems like the same riverbank. Everything has changed, moment by moment. Confucius said, while looking at a stream, it's flowing constantly day and night. And so we have this progression of impermanence happening constantly. What are you laughing about? Come on. He's not going to tell me. You're not going to tell me, all right. So things are constantly changing, and but the trouble is, we as humans want things to be permanent. This is where the problem happens. This is where the bad times happen. Where we go, okay, I don't want this to change. This is perfect. This is a great situation. I don't want this to change. Bingo, it changes. And it's almost as though we get a bit of a shock about it. And we go, oh, it's changed. My mother, who's 90, says to me, things just keep changing. I go, well, yeah. Of course they keep changing. That's the way things are. Things are impermanent. If things weren't impermanent, imagine... Well, it's impossible to imagine, actually. You can't imagine a thing... Just try and check out with your minds what it would be like if now never changed. This is it. Horrible. I'd be looking at you and you'd be looking at me for the rest of eternity. I mean, good grief. I'm sure you've got better things to do with your time. But truly, if we thought about everything being solid and permanent, it would be a complete... Nothing would change. Nothing would change at all. And therefore, our suffering would never change. And we would have no way of bettering ourselves, of changing our minds, of improving our situations, and eventually becoming enlightened. So impermanence is actually our best friend. Impermanence is really something that we need to understand and to accept completely. A friend of mine, a number of years ago, I met him. I hadn't seen him for quite a few years, and I said, oh, how are you? He said, oh, my mother died last year. I said, yeah, that happens, doesn't it? And he went, yeah, actually. It was kind of like his mother had died, and it was almost like he was saying that he hadn't remembered that mothers are dying constantly, and fathers are dying, and kids are dying, and things are happening all the time. And if you start to accept that this is the way impermanence is, then there is not as much suffering. Sure, there's connections with our folks, and we love them and whatever, but we have to realise this is the nature of change. And there's nothing that we can do to stop change. We can influence a little bit, but eventually things decay. The Buddha implored us not to just talk about impermanence, but to use it as an instrument to help us penetrate deeply into reality and obtain liberating insight. We may be tempted to say that things are impermanent and there is suffering, but the Buddha encouraged us to look again. Without impermanence, life is not possible. Without impermanence, life isn't possible. So it's a matter of transforming that suffering of impermanence into the way of liberation. Okay, I've got some other quotes here which are quite good. Early Buddhism declared that in the world there is nothing that is fixed and permanent. Everything is subject to change. Everything created is impermanent. Decay is inherent in all component things. It's almost at the moment we've made something, it's already decaying. Except that existence is flux and continuous becoming. The moment of the continuous becoming. Interestingly enough, in the Hindu system, they say everything is impermanent except the stillness of self, which is an unusual kind of concept. Buddhism doesn't accept it in that way. It sees that even the self, in its continuous consciousness, is changing. And if we look at our minds this morning, when we got out of bed, who got out of bed grumpy? You did, did you? Okay, so some of us got out of bed grumpy. Who got out of bed happy? Yeah, cool. Okay, so all the people who got out of bed grumpy, how were they at 11 o'clock? Were they still grumpy? They were still grumpy. Okay, how about 1 o'clock? Lunch break, so you're happier. Okay. So already we have a change. All right? It took a few hours, but we got there. And so if we look at our mind, it's constantly changing. We're going from happy to sad to indifferent to constantly shifting. Now, if the mind is controlled, it would still shift, but it doesn't have to fixate on the negatives. doesn't have to fixate on the negative experiences. But we have to recognise, and the good news also is if we're in a difficult situation, it will eventually end. If we're feeling tragic, and this is one of the things that's very sad about people suffering depression, is that they don't think it's going to change. And if you've ever been depressed, and all of us have at some point, when we're in the middle of it, it feels like it goes on forever. But it can change. And that's the good news. So difficult situations eventually finish. It's the nature of karma and the nature of impermanence. Conversely, good times also finish. So we have to allow ourselves to let go, because being in the present, it means that we're in a constant movement from the past to the future, and we're the kind of the middle point of that experience. And if we accept that, it gives us a great deal of power in our lives. The sheer fact of trying to make things permanent, to make our happiness as permanent, creates us a lot of suffering. Isn't that bizarre? It's like the paradox. Trying to make things really permanently happy by sheer force of will stops us observing what is actually going on and creates a suffering. My teacher Geshe Lodin learnt his English from many television programs, and they happened to be some of them soapies, midday ones. And he would often say in the beginning of learning his English, he said, "My first love, my only love." How untrue that is. What's the divorce rate in this country? But that's something that we hang on to. 50%, right, 50%. So 50% of people, my first love, and not really my first or second or third or fourth. Anyway, it goes on. So the truth of it is that this hanging on to situations creates a suffering. And that doesn't mean that we can't have enduring relationships, but they too will end. Every beginning ends with a finishing. And very difficult. My grandmother said after 50 years of marriage, when my grandfather died, she said, and each year made it more difficult to lose him. So there is suffering. I mean, it's not that we can move out of that, but for her, she was in a state of, I guess, thinking that it was a permanent experience. And now that's not a crime. That's just the way we're brought up to see the world. We want things to be concrete, always in pleasure, but it doesn't happen that way. Good times followed by bad times followed by good times, and it's constantly changing. And if we get our head around this is, when I first got into Buddhism, someone said this is one of the, impermanence is one of the most important realizations that you can develop. The idea of understanding that this is a continual flux of life. And I'm going to read something here. Take, for example, the life of an individual. It's a fallacy to believe that a person would remain the same person during their entire lifetime. Every moment changes. In fact, we actually live and die every moment. A person is what he is in the context of time in which he exists. It's an illusion to believe that the person you have seen just now is the same person you are just now seeing. It is an illusion to believe that the person you have seen just now is the same person as the person you are just now seeing, or the person whom you are seeing now will be the same person you will see after a few moments. In other words, could someone translate that? The point being is that there is that person that you are looking at now is already changing. Where is the child that you were when you were five? No longer exists. At which point did that child not become a child? Where was the point? See, the fact that emptiness exists is also the reason that impermanence exists. There is no one point where something isn't changing constantly. We think that this room isn't decaying, and the physicists will tell us that it's in a state of decay. Is that correct?
It's not radioactive.
It's not radioactive. I hope not. But aren't the molecules gradually breaking down?
The compounds. Yes.
The compounds are breaking down. Okay. So the compounds within these walls are actually breaking down. Hopefully slower than the time we get out of here. But they're breaking down. Our bodies are constantly changing, breaking down, renewing themselves. So it's about getting this understanding constantly in our minds. And what I'd like you to do over the weekend is just contemplate impermanence around you. Just check it out. See how it works. And the meditation on impermanence, the best one that I've found, is to go near a stream and look and see if you can see the stream moving or a waterfall. I did this just recently. I did a meditation walk, in a sense, in November. And a lot of these people hadn't done a lot of meditation. And I got them to sit beside this incredible waterfall in the bush and just recognize, to try and fixate on one point within that waterfall, like one drop. And it was impossible. It was moving so fast. And I said, this is the way life is, constantly. Now, knowing that gives us a great insight into grabbing the best of what we can have. If I think, well, let's talk about relationships. If I'm in a relationship with someone and I think that they're permanent, which we kind of just generally feel like, oh, this is going to go on. What happens is that we often can take that person for granted. The point at which they depart from our lives or we depart from their lives is absolutely unknown. We can't predict when that point is going to happen. And you hear occasionally great tragedies where people have had an argument and their loved ones walked away and got hit by a car and they said, oh, the last thing I had with that person is an argument. So recognizing impermanence makes us a little bit more compassionate, I would hope, to the ones we care about. There was a fabulous line from a couple that had been married for 60 years, and they asked the husband what his attitude was to having a long, happy marriage. And he said, well, it's respecting my wife, having compassion, understanding, listening. And they asked her, and they said, what's your secret? She said, a short memory. And in some ways, it's kind of a good answer. Because the stuff we hang on to, it's finished and gone. There was, I've told this story before, where a girl had gone out with this guy on the first date. He'd been married before. And they were sitting having dinner, and he said, oh, I feel really, really cut up, actually. He said, my ex-wife took everything from me, and he said, I'm so furious about it. And really, and she was being very sympathetic, thinking, oh, this guy's really gone through hell, aren't you? And midway through the conversation, she said, oh, how long have you been divorced? He said, oh, 10 years. Now, I think he didn't get the idea that his relationship was impermanent to begin with, but 10 years of hanging on to something, he's trying to take that suffering through when it's completely gone. And I don't think she went out on a second date. And the truth of it is that we often do hang on to things that we think should be concrete. And so we have to actually be prepared to recognise this constantly. So I'm attacking this from every possible angle. But particularly with people that we care about, if we think that we have only moments to be on this planet, how essential are we going to be with our relationships? And we don't know that something isn't going to happen to us. And so if we care about people, maybe it's time now to say that we actually do love them rather than think, oh, I'll do it later. It really gets down to that point. And therefore, we don't have regrets later on going, I wish I had have done that. And the reason that we don't do it is because at some level we don't think we're impermanent, I mean, how many of us actually honestly feel that we're impermanent? I don't. I think I'm continuing. You know, if I go out tonight and disappear, I'll be very upset. Because I think I'm going to go on for ages, but I really don't know. So we always have this kind of illusion that we're not, that we are permanent. We think things are permanent. If we get over that, if we get over that and start to develop some understanding, then we start to really take the essence of life quite strongly. We seize the moment. Does anyone do Latin here? Carpe diem. Yeah, how can you say seize the moment? The carpe diem seize the day, isn't it? How do you say seize the moment?
I don't know. I didn't know that that's the
phrase. Oh, so you don't do Latin, you just swipe the phrase. Okay, fair enough. I'd like to know what it is. But it's really about seizing the moment. What can I do right now? Because this moment will not happen again. Sometimes I say to myself, particularly if I'm somewhere enjoying something particularly poignant, it might be a sunset or it might be talking with someone, I say to myself, grab this, remember this, this won't happen twice. Or if you have, you just might meet someone in the street and have an amazing conversation. At one point in my life in the 80s, I did some travelling by myself across the world in various places. And I had the most extraordinary, exquisite experiences, and maybe for 5 minutes talking to somebody. And I kept saying to myself, grab this. I purposely, interestingly enough, didn't take many photos because I didn't want to see my life through a set of pictures. I didn't want to be going, oh, that's a good shot. I didn't want to experience my experience of travelling by going, oh, that's a good shot. And then you go, have you ever done a lot of photos and you've taken them back to, and photos of things that have been really important to you, and you've taken them back to show your friends? And they go, oh yeah, oh yeah, yeah, oh great, no, I had a good time. Mm-hmm. Don't you want to see them again? No, yeah, right. Have you ever experienced that? Some of the most incredible moments you've taken a photo of, and everyone goes, oh yeah, great. Anyway.
Wedding photos.
Wedding photos, yeah. It was a fabulous wedding. Oh yeah, bride's lovely. And that's, in a sense, what we're trying to do with, and I'm not saying, you know, photography, you shouldn't do your photography, but have a think about it. It's trying to capture the moment and make it still, and then impress everyone else by what a fabulous time you've had. And so I made a point when I travelled, I took a few photos, but I made a point of just experiencing what was happening, because that was the essence of the experience. And a photo, if I took it for someone else, they'd go, oh yeah, that's nice. And maybe a bit of a reminder, you know, while I was standing looking up at the Eiffel Tower, it was a wet day and there was a particular feeling in the air and a particular smell of Paris and the light and everything, and I kind of thought, nah, I'm not going to take a photograph of the Eiffel Tower. There's been 10 billion photos of the Eiffel Tower. I'm just going to stand here and just feel what it's like. Because it's never going to happen again for me like this. I could go back to that Eiffel Tower 1,000 times, but that one moment in time that I was there that time was the only time that I was experiencing it that way. And what impermanence does, when you start to look at that, it develops your concentration into the moment. It starts to place you in the frame of time rather than in the future or in the past. Because it's never going to come this way again. Tonight will never happen again. Yeah, hopefully we will sit in front of each other again. It'll be a different topic, it'll be a different time. I'll be older, you'll be older. You will have had experiences during the day which were different. It won't be a second time. This is it. This is the best we get at the moment. What the future brings, we have no idea. So recognizing this constant change, we then start to become relevant to the moment. And that relevancy is really where our lives are. And we let go this fear of the future and fear of the past, or worry about the past. We can't fix it. It's gone. As they say, today's news item is tomorrow's fish wrapping. Constantly changing. And so by focusing on that, and in a sense this is where meditation, it brings us into the present, but the present moment is constantly being renewed when you meditate, it's not just like a block of wood. You don't just shut the mind down and go solid, do you? It's a dynamic process of paying attention to the present. And paying attention to the present gives you an understanding of the impermanence of that present. Very interesting. Does anyone want to share any insights they've had on impermanence? It's a shock, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a shock, but in other ways it's kind of a relief, because in one way the thoughts that you had about the world are shattered, and when you come to accept it, it's actually kind of a relief.
Yeah, that's great. Well put. Thank you. Did everyone get that? It's like you hold on to these beliefs, this is the way it is, and you're right. As we're kids, we think this is the way it's going to be, and all of a sudden it shifts. And it shifts, and in a sense it's reaffirming truth. Truth is things are impermanent, and when things become impermanent in terms of lives, it's reaffirming that we're on the right track of understanding that. In many ways the whole of society tries to completely ignore and play down this idea that things are changing. It tries to shift that away, because in some ways we may feel it confronting or even a little bit scary, but once you really get into it, it is a liberating understanding, because the truth of it is, and the good news about it is, that if we can change, we can also change for the better. We can change our way of thinking, we can change our karmic potential by our functioning, because if things weren't locked and solid and predetermined in a sense, then we wouldn't have the opportunity to change. So in a way, karma is a good sign of that, because in some ways what we're experiencing now is a result of previous karma, okay, in terms of karmic understanding. But at the moment of this interface of karma, we have the opportunity of change. So it's almost at that intersection we can make a decision. And I'll give you an example of that. Someone comes up to me and they start abusing me, they start telling me I'm whatever, and at that moment of point of change, so I've been happily sitting having a cup of tea and someone comes up and says, I think you're absolutely crummy, right? At that moment I have a complete choice of changing direction of that karma, of making in a sense that karma impermanent. If I recognise that my previous karmic cause has created this situation right now, I can then change it at right angles and change it into a completely different experience for the future. So if I send that person compassion and love, if I send that person even understanding and say, look, why are you upset? I really want to understand this. Then by sending them compassion and love, I have just created a new karmic situation of them turning up in my life as a friend, not of someone that's abusing me. And so, all of a sudden, I'm not locked into this situation. But if I feel that this is an ongoing situation or something that can't be shifted, then I won't make any right decisions. But knowing that through the sheer nature of impermanence, sheer nature of change, I can change that karmic future by being compassionate to that person, or conversely abusing them back and creating that person to turn up in my life again as a negative experience. So we have this extraordinary ability, and thank goodness for impermanence in that situation, otherwise the person would be abusing me for eternity and that would be extremely unpleasant. So it's about recognizing these moments, and this is what I found in Buddhism particularly. It's about dealing with the actual truth of what's going on. And this is where strong faith can become very powerful, based on logic and understanding and wisdom. There's many things that we can't really prove, in a sense, the existence of previous lives. And in many ways, we can't really even prove karma. We can understand it. But we can really actually prove impermanence. We can prove that impermanence actually functions. So there's something very concrete. We know that, we experience it, and we understand it. Some more information. Even from the scientific point of view, this is true. We know cell divisions take place in each living being continuously. Old cells in our bodies die and yield place continuously to new ones that are forming, like the waves in the sea. Every moment, many thoughts arise and die in each individual. Psychologically and physically, we are never the same at any one point in time. Technically speaking, no individual is ever composed of the same amount of energy. Mental stuff and cellular material all the time are subject to change, and change is a continuous movement. Impermanence and change are thus the undeniable truths of our existence. What is real is the existing moment. The present that is a product of the past or a result of the previous causes and actions. This is an interesting statement. Because of ignorance, an ordinary mind conceives them to be all part of one continuous reality. But in truth, they are not. So we look at our reality and we have this illusion that everyone's seeing it the way we do. Isn't that amazing? That each of us in this room at the moment have a completely different reality. Well, not completely different. There's a consensus on certain things, but we all have a different reality. None of our realities are the same. We are all viewing our realities differently. Often I say to people that it's almost like in some ways we have a little projector sitting there, and we project a reality out from our own experience, and then we look at it and go, oh, that's the way things are, but the actual, we're holding the projector. And it's a bizarre way of looking at it, but it's actually true. Otherwise, every piece of food that we eat, everyone else should like, if we like it. Or a piece of music, we go, oh, this is a great piece of music, listen to this, and the person goes, no, I don't like it. For me, it's a reality of truth that that piece of music is actually true, and it's good, and it's fabulous, and the other person doesn't like it, and I can't work out why, because it's a fabulous piece of music. No, it's a fabulous piece of music from my perspective, not their perspective. And so we all have these different perspectives. But we're all existing, in a sense, in the same impermanence. So eventually, in some ways, we can have the similar view. Do you get that? So although we can say, oh, my life is different, I see things differently, in many ways, the truths are the same for all of us. That things are impermanent, that things will constantly change moment by moment, second by second. In fact, have you heard the understanding that in a finger snap, there's 65 mind moments to a finger snap? That's how fast our minds move. We have these extraordinarily quick minds. The various stages in the life of a man or a woman, childhood, the adulthood, the old age, are not the same at any given time. The child is not the same when he grows up and becomes a man, nor when the latter turns into an old man. The seed is not the tree, though it produces the tree. And the fruit is also not the tree, though it is produced by the tree. The concept of impermanence and continuous becoming is central to early Buddhist teaching. It is by becoming aware of it, by observing it and by understanding it, one can find a suitable remedy for the sorrow of human life and achieve liberation from the process of impermanence. So, little exercise. Say we live for 80 years. And say the person is halfway through, they're 40. None of you are 40. But say someone was halfway through. Out of the sleep of, say, 8 hours, if you're lucky, over 14 years, do you know how long we spend sleeping? 13 years. In 40 years, we spend 13 years being sound asleep. So that leaves 27 years left. Eating, cooking, washing up, say 4 hours a day. Some people may spend more in eating, but 4 hours a day. So that's, by 40 years, that's 6 years of eating, washing up and preparing food. 6 years. That leaves us 21 left. Cleaning our bodies, putting on makeup, cleaning house, making beds, say 3 hours a day, be roughly that, times 40 years, there's another five years we've spent doing that. That leaves us 16 years. And then if we decide to work 8 hours a day or longer, there's another 13 years. Can you see how our lives are taken up in so many activities? Then there's illness, television, reading, study. So, email, absolutely. How much time do we spend reading useless emails? And then you've got Twitter, Facebook, and it goes on. I keep getting emails from various people saying, join my Facebook. And I go, no, I haven't got the time. And then you can put all your photos on the internet and everyone can look at them. It's extraordinary how this has expanded. And here we have all these activities that at death time are actually no use to us. The only thing that goes with us at death time is the conditioning of our minds towards virtuous karmic conduct. That's the only thing that we take forward. Now that doesn't mean that we can't use these various tools for positivity. Cooking for someone and dedicating the merit of cooking for someone is a great thing to do. So it's not that the activity is useless, it's more to do with the motivation behind it. But they all finish, they all go, everything that we've done. And so if we haven't cultivated our mind, and then this little exercise, we've got in 40 years, you've got about 3 years of mind cultivation. That's about the time that's left, probably less. And we think that we're going to live to 80 years of age. That's something that we kind of, oh yeah, I'll live to 80. But so many of us won't. And if we recognise that our impending impermanence is racing at us very quickly, then we start to become essential. You know, you may not follow Demi Moore around the world on Twitter. You might not want to know what she had for lunch or what restaurant she's sitting in at the moment. I've actually never gone. Has anyone gone on Twitter? Not one of you. My goodness. Yeah, come on, own up. Someone. Not one. Really?
Try asking about Facebook.
The what?
Try asking about Facebook.
Okay, Facebook. You scored. Okay. So tell me, in the activity of Facebook, okay, it gives you a connection with your friends and you see what's going on. I understand that. But what percentage of it becomes an indulgence waste? And I watch television. It's not like I'm sitting here as a saint. I waste my time too. But what happens is that we keep getting more and more involved in activities, and our mind doesn't necessarily get refreshed. We might not get enough sleep, and eventually, when our impending impermanence arrives, we haven't had the time to cultivate our minds in a positive way. And it's only our positive karmic causes that will follow us into the next rebirth. So it's important to remember this stuff, and so therefore it's not about, okay, well, I'll just get rid of everything and I'll meditate every day. It's about understanding how we can use our time wisely, but also cultivating our Dharma practice even when we're using things like Facebook. Actually working out how can this actually be beneficial, right, rather than a waste of time. How can this help someone? Maybe it's contacting someone who needs some emotional help. Maybe it's a way of looking at it in a different perspective, rather than just an indulgence, but in a way of actually being beneficial. I think quite often we get technology and use it very selfishly, but in other ways we can use it in a very positive way. And I think that's important. One of my things in Dharma is, I'm not a great meditator, I'm not a hermit, I don't go and sit in caves for days on end and do extraordinarily advanced practices. But as much as possible when I teach, and what I try to do myself, is focus on the present and see how effective I am when I'm in the present. What's happening right now? How am I driving this car? Am I driving it recklessly? Could I hurt somebody? It's about being essential right in the moment, because I may not get another chance. If I'm driving down the road and I'm thinking really negative thoughts and giving strange hand signals to people who are getting in my way, and just at that moment I'm giving a strange hand signal to someone who's just beat me, I get wiped out by a truck. I am going to die with the most negative thought. Yeah, I'm going to plummet. I'm going to be wiped out with a really negative thought. All right? And a seriously damaged hand in a bad position. And, you know, imagine if they came to find my body and there I was with a strange hand position and a really bad look on my face of negativity. What a tragedy. I might have lived a great life and all of a sudden the last 10 seconds have been a disaster. And I'm actually, apart from the joking about that, I'm actually serious about that. If you walk around with a really negative mind and that's the last experience you have, there's a thing they call in Buddhism about throwing karma, where your rebirth mightn't be so good. So we don't want to die, really the bottom line, to be very Dharma about it, we don't want to die with our mind focused on hatred and anger. We have to get rid of that. And if we don't train ourselves to do that, to watch ourselves very clearly, then that next moment of impermanence may catch us unawares, where we actually do have a negative mind and we don't achieve. We might have had a great life, but all of a sudden we haven't trained our minds well enough and we decide that we're going to be angry for a couple of hours because we think it's justifiable. That doesn't mean that you can't see injustices and make decisions. That doesn't mean that you can't say to people, look, you're doing something wrong here or this isn't working. But it's about harbouring that real, real deep negativity. Or greed. Oh, if only I had that. If only I had that, then I'd be happy. Walking around with that attitude also doesn't work for us. So in a funny kind of way, it's about becoming relaxed in the present. There was a famous old musician. They asked him how he played so well, and he said, it's all easy when you're easy. And it's about becoming easy in the present. You know? These times will pass. Whatever stresses you're under at the moment, and probably a lot of you are under quite a bit of stress at the moment, it's impermanent. And in 100 years, no one will care about it. Not even you. Right? In 100 years, it won't matter.
The same way as when you had the wrong signs when you were dying, nobody cares about
you. No one else will care, but you might if you rebirth, shocking.
But how do we know that?
Well,
there's no scientific evidence.
No, there's no science. No, I can't prove rebirth, so I can't show you any scientific evidence. The only
con- they say that never trust the teacher, never trust how you directly experience.
That's true.
So the other sounds very superstitious to me.
Yeah, sure. In fact,
so
if I
live my life.
That's, you're absolutely correct.
It seems like a bit of superstition.
No. Well,
I'm in trouble because I have this
negative
moment.
Let me put it in a different context. And people have said to me, I don't necessarily believe in rebirth. Can I be a Buddhist? And I say, yeah, the technology of Buddhism works whether you believe in an afterlife or not. It doesn't matter. I happen to believe in it, but that's just a personal belief. The truth of it is that if you live your life well now, you will create harmony in your life now. So is that reasonable?
Yes.
Okay. If there's a rebirth, then you've created a harmonious rebirth, if there's a rebirth. If there's not a rebirth, it doesn't matter, does it? You've just created harmony. So the point being is that it doesn't matter whether you believe in that rebirth. You just have to believe in a virtuous mind, in creating a positive mind.
Some people look at it as if you're living in the ballroom.
Absolutely. Do you know what?
Moment to moment, that's the good flow.
Do you know what you've just described rebirth?
Yes, but rebirth is in this life.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Buddhists would say rebirth in continuing life may be slightly different form. Doesn't matter. You have had a rebirth from your childhood to adulthood. Would you agree? There's a change of function from a child to an adult. So you've had a rebirth.
We're constantly dying, we're constantly...
Absolutely. I think you should be sitting up here. But no, you're absolutely...
Okay, I'm perfectly happy.
You're comfortable there. But the truth, you're absolutely correct, and this is really the essence of it. If you said, I'm only going to worry about rebirth, so I'll just have this kind of silly life here. And in fact, what happened in the Christian church in the 4th century, 400 AD, is that according to sources that I've studied, that the wife of King Constantine, in the Bible, according to some experts, up until 400 AD, there was this notion of rebirth, right? That people got reborn in the Christian Bible. But the queen of King Constantine said to Constantine, look, this is really terrible. Everyone reckons they're getting a second life, so they're goofing off in this life and they're doing all this terrible stuff and going, what's the matter? I'm going to be reborn again. So what happened? The king then said, okay, and he got together with a pope or whoever was in charge at that time and said, all right, we're taking rebirth out of the Bible. If we tell them they've only got one life, they'll become essential. And that's, according to the liberal Catholic Church, which believes in rebirth, that's when they made a split with the normal Catholic Church. You've heard of that too? Yeah. So, interestingly enough, if you get the wrong handle of rebirth, you actually destroy your life. And the point that I guess the Queen's subjects didn't understand was cause and effect. And you've named it. If you live a good life now, tomorrow will be a better life, in a sense of the next day. If your mind is peaceful and harmonious right now, and you develop that very strongly, then your next moment of experience will be peaceful and harmonious. if your mind is generous now, your next moment of generosity might be the next person, and then you create that generosity continuously. And you are rebirthing yourself moment by moment, right now. You have the opportunity of changing the mind from virtuous to negative at any split second. And this is the point where I was saying where the intersection of karma is the point of impermanence that can be changed. That point is, how can I put it? Is very wobbly. At the moment that we're experiencing something, we're about to create something new out of that experience, depending on our mind. And so that point is completely open to change. We can change it in any direction. You can give me a lovely present and I can go, this is absolute rubbish and I wanted something bigger. It's not a nice Rolls Royce. I wanted the silver ghost. You didn't get me the silver. I mean, it seems ridiculous, but take it on a smaller scale, and that's often. And however, I can be very thankful at that moment and very grateful, and that's changed the situation. So we're always on this point, which is incredible, this point of complete shift at any one moment, and we can change that for the positive or the negative. We have the choice. So we can't change the past, but we can change the future, and that's all that's important, because the past is complete history. It doesn't exist. No one can show us the past. It's finished. It's just a figment of our mind, but it has its influence in the fact that we're experiencing the previous causes. So if you develop positive mind, virtuous mind, then you are creating the future that you really want anyway. And that's the beauty about it. So in terms of your comment, and thanks for bringing that up, that's really important. It's not about going, I'll be good now for a good rebirth. It's about, I'll be good now, because that's creating the reality that I want to live in. If I create a reality of negativity, then that's how I experience. One of a guy, I've told this story often, I tell a few stories that you've heard before. There was a guy who was a young martial artist I did some training with. He was from New York. And this guy said to me, he said, oh, how do you deal with the fights you get in, and how do you go? And I went, I've been doing martial arts, well, I've been doing it now for about 40 years. And I said, I don't get in fights. And he said, what do you mean? He said, I'm always getting in fights. He said, how do you stop it? I said, well, I just don't get in fights. And he went, And I spoke to someone a while later, and they said, oh, I saw Joe, he walked into a party like this. And he was always looking for someone that was going to fight him. He was creating his reality of a dangerous world. He wasn't a bad guy, but he was creating a reality of a dangerous world and someone's going to attack him. And so his whole persona and energy was one of fear and aggression. And so anyone that was tuned into fear and aggression, bingo. Oh, that guy's dangerous, I better fight him first. And he had scars and bits out of him all over the place. And I thought, how extraordinary. It was a classic example of someone that was creating the reality that in some ways they didn't want, but through their whole understanding of life is dangerous, everyone's my enemy, they were creating this situation. I often thought, he was only a young guy, I often thought that he possibly wasn't going to live a long life, actually, because at some point someone was going to be better and stronger and faster than he was. And it was a fool's game that he was travelling on. And really, it was very sad that he took up martial arts, because he was in the wrong game. Absolutely the wrong game. Someone, in fact, one of these classes, a few years ago, someone said to me, well, you call yourself a Buddhist. It was very provocative. I quite liked it, really. They said, you call yourself a Buddhist and yet you teach martial arts. How do you put those two together? And I said, very clearly, I said, well, you find a martial art that doesn't hurt someone. And then you have the perfect martial art. You protect that person from harming you, and you protect them from harming themselves. And there are martial arts out there. In fact, the martial art that I train in, which is Tai Chi, is the martial art of not harming others. By energetically and compassionately working with that person. The famous master who was the teacher of my teachers, Master Wong, had this wonderful ability of throwing someone and making them land on the ground very softly. So they never hurt themselves. Which is fantastic. So if you're going to develop a martial art, make sure it's one that doesn't harm people. And then you have developed compassion. You may be able to show them the error of their aggression, but do it in a very gentle and sweet way. And so it's about attitude and the way you change. It's not necessarily always the activity, it's the way that you look at it that can change the reality for yourself and create this moment-by-moment rebirth. That you can rebirth yourself constantly in a positive way. And so, but to do that, you have to be vigilant. You can't just kind of let it go and go, oh, well, you know, I'll think about it tomorrow. I'll just be grumpy today. And when you get up in the morning and you're grumpy, as you told us, how many people were at the end of your grumpiness? One. Who was that? Your flatmate. He copped it, did he? She. She copped it. She deserved it. Okay. Thank you very much. Now we talk about justifiable anger. Let me explain that, yes, she may have created some havoc in your life, but the havoc that you experienced was due to your previous karma, and she was just the catalyst for you experiencing that negative karma. So I'd bunch of flowers would be a really good idea. Because, you know what? That's going to create a positive effect on your flatmate for the future. Do you agree?
Sure.
You agree, yeah. Trust me, someone mentioned the other night, which is a great line, they said, an apology is a bucket of water on a fire. It works brilliantly. Yep, my fault, very sorry. And not necessarily... how can I show this? I'm going to give you a demonstration. Right.
So here we have...
Am I going to hit you?
No. Please don't. I have a glass jaw. Okay, so we have this situation, right? Now, his position is that he is absolutely determined that he is right. Right? And he's got his team of litigation lawyers behind him, and I've got my team. Right? And the thing about him is that he wants to prove his position is absolutely correct. Right? So he takes my arm with both hands. Now, the thing being is when you're in a position like this, he's getting nervous. When you're in a position like this, right?
Are you getting Tai Chi me?
When you're in a position like this, his position becomes absolutely right, all right? Have you ever been in that position where the argument is gone but your position to be right is more important than resolving the argument? You been there? Okay, so you don't move, all right? But hang on.
Okay.
So you don't move. But I've decided... Keep hanging on.
Okay.
I've decided that... I want to understand his point of view. So I've let go of my position. Right? Does he look a bit more awkward? Right? I've let go of my position because I want to understand. So I'm going in his direction. So this is communication. However, this isn't comfortable for him because he just wants to be right. He's not interested in... This is where the issue gets out of control. Where... The person sees that their position should be absolutely correct. They're not interested in resolving the conflict. So he pushes my hands down to confront me. Now, he's going in my direction and I have complete control over him because I'm quite happy to let go of the position. And this is called conflict resolution. All right? It's also martial arts.
Now you tell me.
So you understand the idea behind it. It's about resolving the conflict
not proving that you are right. That's just ego grasping. And so the idea of an apology is where you let go of the ground and say, look, I'm really sorry for upsetting you. Rather than, yeah, go on. Please?
No, there was one speaking.
Yes.
And she was something, I'm not sure what I said or something that I've done really upset her.
Mm.
The child that was an infant as well. And that moment of end up in a very big fuse, and I just told her that I'm leaving you because you're getting angry. I left the room and she actually exploded.
Not physically. Yeah, yeah.
And went to the big issue, and the management came down and wanted me to go in and apologize.
Yes.
So I have to go in and say that I'm sorry that you are angry. Which I really was sorry that she was angry.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether there was an apology on my side, but I was sorry that she was angry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is difficult when you've been accused of, you know, you're actually correct and someone is accusing you of flipping out. But in a sense, you can apologise for their anger. You can say, look, I'm really sorry that that's upset you. There is a point, though, where you have to also say, no, I'm sorry, that is correct. What happened there is correct. There has to be a point where it's not about completely... See, in that little exercise there, I was conceding ground, but I wasn't losing my integrity. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't just going, oh, whatever. I was understanding the situation. Do you like that one? I was understanding the situation. I was letting go of my ground to resolve the conflict. Right? That's called communication. Eventually, though, by them forcing the communication, they had to end up going in my direction. Not that I planned it, but that was the way things went because I was letting things become fluid. I mean, it's a simple thing, and human relationships are a lot more conflagrated than that particular exercise. But it just gives you a bit of an insight that if we're working on the right motivation for something, great things can happen. And going to someone and say, look, I'm really sorry. In fact, something happened in my family just recently where a cousin got very angry with another relative, and both of them rang me up. The cousin that was really steam coming out of her ears going, oh, they shouldn't have done it. And then I spoke to the other person, and they said, I didn't do anything wrong. And I said, right, we need to calm the cousin down, so you have to write a letter. And you have to apologise completely. Even though you thought you were in the right, you did step out of line. So I stepped in the middle and I said, you're going to have to write a letter of an apology. And he did. He wrote a very long letter of apology, which I edited. There wasn't enough grovelling in it, but that was then sent, and the person that was angry then calmed down. That was the bucket of water on the fire. Alright, and big deal if you say, I'm sorry, I did that, it was wrong. It's that ego grasping of I don't want to be wrong, I want to be right, that causes us all our problems and always has. And it's being powerful enough. I remember Sogyal Rinpoche, who wrote the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, he said, the extraordinary yogis give away everything. You can take anything from them. And he said, that is so powerful. And that's really the art of going, okay, you want to say that I'm, okay, I'll be wrong. I don't have a problem with that. Because if there is great integrity with that, in the sense of you understand that person needs to resolve it in a particular way, you're doing quite a kind act. But that doesn't mean that you don't clear your name, okay? If there's something going around. So it's a tricky thing. This is why relationships are so complex. It's not about just going, oh, I'm wrong, I do everything wrong, and you know whatever you want to say to me. It's not that. You also have to have a certain level of integrity in what you're doing. But particularly when there's a conflict, try and understand the other person, and then occasionally you just have to walk away from it. They may choose, you might do all the right things, you might apologise, you might even take a back step in the relationship and they're still angry, well, that's their problem. You have to sometimes just walk away from them because you can't change them. That may be their opinion for life. And, you know, look, even the Buddha had an enemy, didn't he? Who was the Buddha's enemy? Devadatta. Devadatta tried to kill him. He was unbelievably jealous of the Buddha. He dropped rocks on him and got wild elephants and poisoned his food. So there was this incredible person trying to help all beings and save them from suffering, and a perverted view was that he was a bad man, so Devadatta tried to kill him. So none of us get out of here without some people disliking us. That's just the way it is, and we just have to accept that. Samsara is imperfect, but thankfully it's impermanent too, and those things will change. And people come into your lives and go out of your lives very quickly. Hang on for time. Any other points you want to make? Your experience? Yep. Yeah. So do you think that was almost like a bit of a catalyst? Yeah. I think it often happens that way. Yeah. Yeah. But this happens all the time. We're often discriminated against, whether we're race or whatever, these things happen. But yeah, I think I agree. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, we'll never know because you can't repeat the experience and you wouldn't want to. But yeah, it is quite often that look, one thing I learnt in New York, walk like a person in New York if you don't want to get mugged. All right? Trust me. And in fact, when I was travelling around the world, I used to sit in a cafe and observe how the locals walked, and I took up the gait. And it was really fascinating. At one point I'm in Rome and this American couple come up to me and say, "Excuse me, will you stand in front of fountain?" Yeah, sure. No, I didn't. I didn't disillusion. They thought I was an Italian, so I thought, oh, well, we'll just go with the flow. This will make them happy. And so I learnt to walk like an Italian in Rome because it was safer and it made less trouble. Walk like an Egyptian, exactly. I think there's a song in that. But learning, and it was interesting because when I did that, I felt very relaxed. You know? I didn't walk around, and, you know, one thing you don't want to do if you ever... Who's been to New York here? Yeah. You don't want to walk around like a tourist at night in New York, do you? You just walk. But you don't want to be going because something will happen. You have to be...
Better to go with the flow.
Yeah, go with the flow and just blend in. So that paranoia, unfortunately, people that are aggressive will pick up on that fear very, very easily. one of the reasons I don't get in fights is because I don't project the fear and I don't project aggression, and I completely try and disappear if there's any situation. I also choose not to go to places where there's going to be brawls happening either. You know, that's kind of wisdom, I think, actually. And all the good martial artists I know, the ones I've known over the last 40 years, are never getting fights. They confidently get the hell out of there. It's called feel the fear and run like hell. But it's a wise thing to do, and knowing how to preserve ourselves, we can also be helpful with other people and pass that wisdom on too. I think ultimately, it's that projection, and thank you for saying that too, it's the projection of our mind into everything that creates our suffering eventually. it's looking out there and seeing people who are different and thinking negatively of them. We've already created the karma, maybe in a future life, to have that happen to us. So it's about constantly watching our mind and checking out what's going on. Are we projecting a negative thought? We might be lucky and it mightn't come flying back at us at the time, but I've also had an experience like that when I was about 17. I was walking up a street and I saw, and this is before I was a Buddhist, and I can talk from the experience in this one. I was walking up a street in Chatswood, I was 17 years of age, and I'd just done 2 years of karate. And I saw this guy walking down the street, and he was the roughest looking biker you could imagine, with eyes like black coals. And do you know what? For one split second, as a 17-year-old youth with bravado, I thought, geez, I wonder if I could take him on in a fight. And he just went and walked straight up to me and went, bang! It was 1 second of thought, and he was like a homing pigeon, because his mind was so attuned to fear and aggression. I must have looked at him in a funny way or whatever. And all of a sudden, I was in the middle of it, so I know exactly what you mean. And that was my projection, and I ended up in a brawl, the only one I've ever had in my life. And I learned a really good lesson. Don't look at bikies and think, I wonder what you're doing. So, yeah, luckily I survived, but it was pretty ugly. And later I really recognised that it was my fault. Here was a person who was acting on their instincts that just beat people up for the hell of it. But I actually created the situation. I created the situation by having, it wasn't even an aggressive thought, it was an inquisitive thought. Because I wasn't feeling angry at him or anything. It was like, oh, I wonder if what, you know, I guess it was an ego-grasping thought, thinking, oh, I wonder how my martial arts would go against this huge bloke. Not very well, actually. And so again, it's what we put out is what we get back. And it's really clear about that. And so therefore, if we're putting out positive energy, that's what we'll receive. And that's what we'll get this life or next life. Doesn't matter. It's what we're going to get. Okay, I think I've done enough tonight. We're going to have a bit of an early mark. Does anyone else want to put any more information in at all, they think, or experiences? It's been actually particularly good tonight. So what you've all spoken about has been very useful. Yep?
You talked about not dying with anger. Mm-hmm. What about dying with sadness and sorrow?
Same. Yeah, well, we have... It's not as... Anger is the most negative thought, because it's usually projected at someone. But also dying in regret. Yeah, dying with sadness. Look, some of our relatives will die in sadness, and that's particularly sad, and it happens. But let's... us not do that, okay? And the reason we will die in sadness and regret is because we haven't lived a positive life right now. Do you see what I mean?
If you have like kids or stuff, you will regret like not being able to see what you make their part of your life.
Absolutely, but the higher view of that, okay, and there can be understanding of that, but the higher view of that is that by being sad and regretful will not make their lives better and they won't make your life better. Yeah. But we don't have to rest on saying, oh, this is the way it is, this is my human nature. In fact, that's what the Buddha was really saying, is that we can change that accepted human nature. See, for me, if I'm going to die, I don't want my son sitting beside me and me going, oh, I'm going to die, and it's terrible, I'm going to die, and I'm so sad, and watch him go through the torture of me being sorrowful. That's something that I don't particularly... That doesn't mean that I wouldn't connect and we'd cry together, but I wouldn't like him to see me in an incredibly negative state before I die, because what's that going to do for him? That's not compassionate from my side. And let's face it, if I've been a Buddhist my whole life, I'm going, hey, hold it, I think I'm impermanent. I've just worked it out. Probably a bit earlier than I wanted to be, but... or whatever, or maybe too late. I mean, I have a mother now that's saying at 90, I've lived too long. And I said, you said that at 75 and you're now further down the track. And I said to her, in fact, if you keep saying that, you'll probably get to 110. But I think that point is important. Try not to have the negative mind at any particular point as possible. But if you have a negative mind, investigate it and find out what you're feeling about it.
In the context that there is no afterlife, there is no rebirth,
yeah,
so to speak, into another form, does it really matter then the frame of mind in which we die? If this is all there is, then...
Okay, that's a reasonable scenario. If all there is, the frame of mind that we die in, if there is no rebirth, yeah, I suppose the last moments, but why would you want your last moments on Earth to be negative?
No, I'm not saying that I want it to
no,
be
no,
negative,
no,
but
no.
If they are negative, then what implications would it
well,
have?
Well, no implication if there's no rebirth. I agree, that's a clear scenario. However, it would be terrible to go, oh, well, I'm just going to be miserable. I'm damned. Now I've just been reborn in a really miserable place and I could have actually changed it. So, you know, I call that about having a bet the right way, you know? But truthfully, the point I'm also making is indulging in negativity. You've had a good life, and the last 24 hours you're in sorrow and negativity. That's
why.
That's why. You know, I'd like to die laughing. It'd be fun. I mean, it would be preferable, wouldn't it? And there are people. I remember a friend of mine, a Buddhist friend of mine, was working in a Catholic hospice, and there was this Mother Superior who had really severe bone cancer, and she was a very old Catholic nun and she was really suffering. And in the last 2 weeks of her life, my friend would walk past this old nun's room and she was sewing her rosary beads. And she walked in and she said, Mother, what are you doing? She said, oh, I'm praying for all the sick people in the world. She said, I haven't got long to go and I need to spend all my time praying for all the sick people in the world that they may not have suffering. Well, what an extraordinary situation. Now, whether she has a rebirth or not, the effect that she had on everyone around her, and including my Buddhist friend, was incredibly powerful. She said, compared to some of the other nuns that had let their negative mind, and they were complaining all the time, and they were abusing the nurses, and I'm in pain, and, you know, here was this old nun that they knew was in really quite severe pain. And there she was praying for others. And they said when she died, her room was like a shrine. It was had this most incredible feeling of sanctity. And she said all the nuns went in there and sat down and prayed in there because just after she'd passed away, there was this incredible euphoria in the room because her mind had been incredibly positive. So, you know, if there's no rebirth, doesn't matter. But the fact of her passing, and even the fact of her passing, I'm telling you guys, is extraordinary. She had a really powerful effect on my life and I never even saw her. So this is the difference between harbouring the negative mind or working with a virtuous mind, the positive mind. We can make it work, even for people like me who've never even met the other person. I think it was a fabulous story. Okay. Yep. Not your problem. You do the best you can. You can't change people. Do what?
Hang around with positive people.
Yeah. Exactly. Hang around with positive people. But if they've got a negative mind, it's not your place to change them. It's just your place to be positive. Thanks, folks. That was fun. Good.